My job up here is to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I will tell you right now, I'm not the same person that I came in 24 years ago. My life has changed dramatically. And it's through the 12 steps, the spiritual steps that we've been given, and the 12 traditions and the concepts that I am standing here today, sane and sober. Well, sane as much as I can be, but very, very much different from where I came. I was born in Petersburg, just a little south of Richmond, and to a nice Jewish family. I was the youngest of six, and the only thing that I can remember as a kid is fear. I was a fearful kid. I don't know why I was fearful. All my sisters and brothers, I would look at them, and I don't know, they just seemed to have it together. The ages go like this. As of today, 63, 64, 65, 66, 72, and 73. I'm tired. I'm overwhelmed saying it. But growing up, I thought was hard. It was difficult for me. I looked at my sisters and brothers who I thought they had it. I don't know what it was, but I wanted it, you know. They just seemed to have gotten the rules, and I didn't get them. And so what happened is, like I said, growing up was so hard to do. At the age of 15, I took my first drink. And I don't know if y'all know this or not, but Jews are not alcoholics. They don't drink. So I took my first drink at the age of 15, and something happened to me. It was like a light switch that just got turned on. I had what we call a spiritual awakening. And now, when I compared myself, which I always did with my family, I mean, I wanted them to love me, to accept me, to approve of me more than anything y'all could ever imagine. I just wanted that love so bad. So I would look at them, and since they weren't doing anything like that, immediately I was a loner when it came to drinking. I had a lot of shame and guilt from the very, very beginning. Even with my friends who were Jewish, because that's what you did, to hang around with Jews. Even those, my friends, did not drink. And so what I would do is I would drink before, you know, I would go meet with my friends. And then eventually, you know, I would leave them and then just keep drinking afterwards. I had so much shame, I never wanted anybody to see how much I drank, or really how I drank. Me still wanting to be loved and love, you know, I did everything according to my family. At the age of 18, I graduated high school. I don't know how I did that, because I made D's and E's all the time. And my sisters and brothers were straight A students. Today, they're all doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs. You know, they're all something and somebody. And when I graduated, I was the only one who didn't go to college. And now, this is all perception. I really felt like I was the biggest disappointment in my family. You know, I really did, because you just did what they did. And I just couldn't follow that. So I ended up moving from Norfolk, because that's where I grew up, from Petersburg, went down to Norfolk. From Norfolk, I moved up to Washington, D.C. And it's like I had arrived. You know, I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And I did. At the age of 19 years old, I was just off and running. I was pretty much in full-blown alcoholism at that time. Now, I didn't start drinking until I was 15. And I know that, you know, a lot of people today, they start at 12 or whatever. So I was an old-timer drinking. And but my drinking started taking on a different road. I didn't seem to have that much trouble, you know, at work until I did. You know, I started drinking just on the weekends, and then what happened, my weekends became Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then, of course, like in the big book, in the story, and more about alcoholism, I couldn't make it even on Mondays. Just like it says, so he showed up to work on Tuesday. Well, what happened to Monday? I know what happened to Monday. So my boss would come to me all the time and go, Sammy, you're just not, you know, living up to your potential. And I would say this, and I had this attitude going on, if any of y'all can imagine. I had this attitude like, yeah, but when I'm here, I'm good. You know, I used to, there was always a wiggle for me. I could always, you know, find something. I had fine-tuned those skills of lying, cheating, and stealing. And so in my family, everybody got married at the age of 21. Back then, that's what you did. I mean, 20, if you were older, you were considered an old maid. So everybody got married at 21, and at the age of 23, I decided I need to get married because I knew things had to slow down some. I didn't know what it was, but I knew my life was pretty much out of control. And so I picked out this perfect specimen. I picked out a nice Jewish doctor. And I picked him out for a couple of reasons. One, he wrote prescriptions. I may be an alcoholic, I'm just not stupid. And then he would be married to his profession, just like doctors usually are, and I could go do whatever I wanted to do, because that's what I was going to do anyhow. But it was just in that my little plans and designs. So then my third reason was my family would love me. I mean, how great is that? Their daughter, their sister is getting married to a Jew. I mean, life couldn't be any better. So, as my mom planned the entire wedding, as my mom did everything, in November 9th of 1974, my parents threw me a $20,000 wedding. And it was right on Granby Street at Temple Israel. But that morning, I called my girlfriend and I said, you know, I was feeling a little thirsty. And so I called her up and I said, let's just go out. So we went out and I took a fifth of vodka and I took four Quaaludes. I was just right. I would have married anybody that was beside me, but I was okay. So on that day, I show up to the wedding. I was the last one there. But I was like, I was okay. I was kind of happy about the day. And I get married, and I was only married for 3 weeks. I have a good reason. I have a good reason. You know, I'm quick with those reasons. What I did to this guy is I went up to my mom and dad and my sisters and brothers, and I lied about him. And everything I said about him was a lie. And my parents and my sisters and brothers were so happy I got rid of him because of the kind of lies that I said. But that's what I did. You know, I couldn't stand making a mistake. I don't like being wrong. I don't like looking bad. So what I would do is I would, as we say today, tweak the truth. But I didn't even know what the truth was. But I love coming out smelling like a rose. I don't like looking bad. So I made it look so bad for him that they were happy. And this was at the age of 23. And I drank till I was 38. I drank for 23 years. And I didn't get, because if you really look at our, you know, our history of our drinking, at the age of 15 to 38, a lot went on during that time. A lot. You know, I used to have a little fun at the beginning. I did. But I was the type of alcoholic that I was an agitator. I always seemed to get in trouble. I don't know what it was, but I found trouble. You know, I was flamboyant. I couldn't hide it. You know, if I was, you know, drunk, everybody in the world knew it. So at the age I was talking to a young lady up there today and her mom. And when I was up at NIH, I was working up there, and I got stricken with multiple sclerosis. And I was in a wheelchair for like a year, and I lost my eyesight. But the NIH put me on disability, and I hated it. I didn't want to be on disability, and also I didn't want MS. I felt so sorry for myself. So what did I do? Drink was my solution. Alcohol was never my problem. It was the solution to all. So a year later, I get out of the wheelchair, and this starts my geographical cures. And I didn't know they were geographical cures, but, you know, I was like, join the Navy and see the world. That's exactly what I did. And the reason is because of the type of alcoholic that I am, and I'll explain that. I have lived in Philadelphia, New York. I've lived in Florida a couple of times. I have lived in so many different places because what I would do is my drinking would become so out of control that I would end up lying with you. I would end up moving in with you and your family, and I would steal from you. And so I would have to leave. You know, and that's the kind of person I was. I would just cause trouble. And so my family was, I ended up with a lot of my sisters and brothers because, you know, when you got a lot of them, you know, they got money, they're rich, why not? So I wasn't working. So I would end up a lot in their homes, and they would have to ask me to leave. My dad, in I don't know what year it was, because I'm not really good at remembering that part. But I was living in Jackson, Tennessee, and my mom called. My dad had gotten sick with mesothelioma. And it's very popular today. You hear it all the time on TV. But this was 30 years ago. And so she had to move him from Norfolk, and he went to MD Anderson in Texas. And my mom had been there with him for a while, and she needed help. You know, my mom really needed a break. So she asked one of her wonderful children, her six children, that if someone could help her. Well, I was the only one not working. I don't have a husband. I don't have children. You know, like my sisters and brothers are having all this wonderful stuff. So I volunteer because I want to be that good daughter. I want to be a good sister. I really do want to be a good person. I just don't have the skills. But I volunteer, and I go down to MD Anderson in Texas, and my mom takes off back to Norfolk, the rest she so needed. Well, I got thirsty, you know, and I don't know why I got thirsty. And I go into my dad's room because you lived in the same room with them, you know, because they needed that help. And I looked at my dad, who couldn't talk. He was aphasic because he had had a stroke in the recovery room. I look at my dad, and I say, "Dad, I'll be right back." Because, see, I was going to have one drink that I see other people taking with impunity, because I needed that ease and comfort, because I was irritable, restless, and discontented, and I didn't know that. I just told myself, I'm going to go have that one drink, and I don't go back for 5 days. And I go back in my dad's room, and, you know, he gives me that look. You know that look you get from people who love you so much, but they just, you know, don't know what to do, and he gives me that look, and I don't know what to do with those feelings. Because, see, I only know how to stuff them. I didn't know that that's what I was doing. But everything that I was doing, I was just stuffing deep down inside me. And he gave me that look again, like, where have you been? What are you doing? You know, and I go up for 2 more days. And I come back, and the nurse pulls me over, and she said, "Sammy, we got to call your family. You know, because your dad's dying." And I'm like, "Oh, my God, you cannot call my family." Because, see, I'm so much fear of my family. Do you hear what I'm saying? I loved my dad with all my heart and soul. He was my hero. I loved him. But all I could do was think about myself. Because selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. But I didn't know that then. And I left. I left in the middle of the night. I left right then and there because I was so afraid. I was in so much fear. And my dad died. And I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to my dad. That's alcoholism. That's alcoholism. Alcohol making all my decisions for me. I couldn't make any decisions without that. So where do you think I end up? I end up down in Norfolk at the funeral. And how do I show up at the funeral? I show up drunk. I didn't want to show up drunk, but I showed up drunk. And I have a sister. I have a lot of sisters, but this sister, her nails were around this big. And she digs them inside me, and she spits on me. And she says, "We don't want you here," you know. And I had this attitude thing going again, you know, that we carry so well. I just flipped my hair, and, you know, I can be here if I want to be here. And I did. I stayed. I stayed after that funeral to help my mom because my mom needed one of her children there. And I did the same thing to my mom. I was out every single night because alcohol had a hold on me. Alcohol was my master. So I did the same thing to my mom. I left her, and I ended up in Naples, Florida. And during Naples, Florida, my oldest sister went down there, and she wanted to start a business. You know, and she had the money, I had the time, so I was going to help my sister. And I did the same thing to her. I just left her in the middle of the night. I was out every single night. Now, by this time, I was still going out. you know, and doing things outside, because by the time I got to you people, I learned to drink alone. And that's the truth. I couldn't stand anybody by me. So I ended up in Richmond, Virginia. Today I don't really know how I got there. You know, I got my car and that's about it. God got me to Richmond. And I had one sister left that I haven't used and abused because she scared me the most. So, but yet I went to her. And my small one, that sister owned a bar, a beautiful, nice restaurant and a bar. It was called Poor Richard's. It was right on Carey Street. And maybe some of you know it. I'll apologize now, make amends if I've did something to you. But during that time, my sister was a full-blown crystal meth addict. And I was in full-blown alcoholism. And I thought it was going to be a blast that was going to last. Well, it was not. I started doing that stuff with her and drinking on a daily basis. And I became very psychotic. I was, you know, picking things out of the air and saving them for later. I was seeing things. I was just a mess. But this is when I started having blackouts more than just, you know, a couple hours or whatever. I was having blackouts for like a week. For 10 years, I remember when I got sober and I heard John Lennon had died, I just cried. I mean, I had no idea. For like the whole 80s, I don't really remember the 80s too well. And that is the truth. I mean, a lot of people can stand up here and they can give you timelines and my husband can tell you what bar he was at anywhere. I really can't tell you a lot of things that I did. And but I did a lot of illegal things there at her restaurant, and we eventually lost it. And so I take, you know, responsibility for that today. But so we split, and I ended up working at this other place called the Village Cafe, right on Harrison and Grace. Now, when I was there, I got a letter from my family. It was typed. Now, it'd been like 5 years already since I talked to my family. 5 years. And in that letter, what they did is they take their sleeve and they rip it. And in the Jewish religion, they literally kill you off. And you're now no longer a member of the family. Well, it killed me. It broke my heart. And at that time, I mean, I was really in a lot of trouble physically and mentally. And what I did with that letter is what I did with everything else. I just threw it away because, see, I can't take it. I can't take anything. I can't take confrontation. I can't take anything that's painful. All I could do was to take another drink. And what I did with that letter, like everything else, I started stuffing that down too. You know, and that attitude came back, well, the heck with them too. But yet, I was dying inside, dying. And my boss had put up some cameras to catch the person stealing, you know. I have skills. And so, but he didn't tell me that he was putting up these cameras. So it was on a Friday night. I come in, and I had to work at night because by this time, I mean, I couldn't even stand the daylight. It was hard for me to get to work. And when I did go there, I just went in the back room. You know, I stayed away from people, places, and things. You know, I just got away. And but I come in that night. It was on a Friday night. And he calls me into the office, and he takes the VCR tape. For you young people, that's old stuff. And he puts the VCR in the player, and he catches me stealing on tape. And I denied it was me. And the reason I denied it was me is because I thought I was invincible. I thought I could do anything without anybody noticing it. You know, why would anybody notice me? Well, the funny part about this is the condition that I was in. It's not really funny, but when I look back on it, you know, I had stopped bathing a long time ago. I mean, bathing was hard. I still don't like it today, but it was hard, you know, and I wore this really long sleeve ripped sweater that I brought into sobriety with me. I mean, I just was covering myself all up. Now, I will tell you that for the only time in my life I was this thin, because I had stopped eating and I had done that crystal meth stuff for like I guess 2 years, but I was this thin. And, of course, I couldn't go out and appreciate it because I couldn't go outside. But and I had worn this headband. I was a hippie. And I wore a headband for like 30, 40 years. And when I got sober, my sponsor made me take it off, and I had this indentation in my head. Truly. But I had I wore this headband. Being a hippie, I had flowers in my hair, and at that time they were dead, but they were still in my hair. And so me denying it was me on that film is pretty funny. But this is what I did. I had that attitude again. When he didn't call the police. He didn't do anything. He just said, "Sammy, you are sick. You need help." And attitude came up again, and I said, "I'll just take my poker chips and move to another table." See, I got skills. I do. I've got skills. I can land on my feet. I have. I've been doing that for a long time. I'll just do it somewhere else. Well, I get in my car, which was trash, just like I was. You know, my car looked just like me. I had 4 retreads. I can change a tire like that because I have skills. And I hadn't seen oil in a long time. And so I get in that car and I go to my apartment, which my disability from the government was taken care of because I was never self-supporting through my own contributions. Never. So I go back to this apartment, which was trashed, just like I was. I was one of those people who was very ashamed. I didn't throw anything away unless I piled it up and I took it to somewhere else so no one would see. And I went to sleep. That's all I did is I went to sleep. And I woke up that next morning and something happened to me. And I know today that it's truly the hand of God. And the big book says, At first, a flimsy reed turns out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And that's exactly what happened. God had touched me, but I didn't know that. I didn't know it. And so I picked up the phone, and I called my best friend's sister. Now, the phone really wasn't mine. I spliced it together with my neighbor's because I have skills. And so I called her up, and she goes, "Sammy, I'll be right there." And I got to tell you, I'm so glad that she didn't say, "I'll be there tomorrow," or "I'll be there after American Idol is on," or "I'll be there." She just came right over. And she took me. She said, "Sam, I'm going to take you to treatment." And I'm like, "Okay." I didn't even know what treatment was. She says, "I'm taking you to treatment." I'm like, "Okay." I get in the car. We go to Tucker's. I'm a graduate. I'm a Tucker nut from Chippenham Hospital. And that was at the end of August. I used September 1st, my sobriety day, because I don't really know what day I was conscious. So I go to Tucker's, and it was one of the best things that happened to me. Going to treatment was good for me. Number one, it got me off the streets. You know, it got me out. And number two, I had a counselor who believed in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, who believed in the power of God. How lucky is that? You know, and I get up in treatment, and I was there with probably around 30 other people. And this was the day that you went for a long time. You were there for 28 days or 30 days. And so they told me when I was up there that I was an alcoholic, that I was a late-stage chronic alcoholic. And I got to tell you guys, I was happy to hear that. Because it wasn't my fault. I'm so glad it was something that it had nothing to do with me. But in reality, it does have everything. But I was so glad. Like, I just wanted to hold up the sign. I have alcoholism, you know. That's the problem. So when I was up there, they said, "Sammy, I want you to look to the left. And I want you to look to the right. Because only one of you are going to make it." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I felt so bad for everybody." Because I knew I was going to be the one. I really did. And the reason is because I was sick of Sammy. It wasn't about the alcohol anymore. It wasn't about that. It was about I was sick of me. Everything that was good and clean and decent in my life was gone. You know, I joke about this, but I had that 2 brain cells left and they were waving goodbye to each other. I remember with them all, when I sat down to do the big book with my sponsor, I couldn't even read. I lost all my reading skills. I don't know, they just evaporated. But I was toasted. And they told me up in treatment, too, that I had to get a sponsor. And I didn't know what a sponsor was. They just told me I had to get one. And since I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought if I didn't get one, I couldn't belong to your club. So, and you know, and I'm still, y'all understand, I'm still looking for the approval, too. So they gave me 7 days to get a sponsor. So on the seventh day, we go downstairs to the meeting, and I run up to this woman, and I said, would you be my sponsor? And I just ran away.
Yeah.
I didn't even wait for her answer, because I didn't know anything about rejection. I didn't know that I was going to feel rejected. And so this woman comes up to me after this meeting, and on a piece of paper, she writes her number, and she hands me that number. And she goes, Sammy, I want you to use it. And she looked me right in the eye. And I got to tell y'all, I felt something that I hadn't felt in a long time, that someone cared. I mean, it went to my bone, you know. And that woman today is still my sponsor, and I have kept her sober for 24 years. And if you're a sponsor, you know what I mean. Because if it wasn't for sponsorship, me helping another suffering alcoholic, which is really the cornerstone, you know, of our program, I don't know. That's where I really learned everything. But I got a sponsor. And when I got out of treatment, my sponsor let me move in with her. I had nowhere to go, really. And she let me move in with her, and I lived with her for that first year. And what happened during that year, this is what happened. My sponsor sat me down, and we went through this book, and we did what it said to do. If it said pray, we prayed. If it says write, we wrote. Whatever it said to do, we, and if you hear the word we, because I never had to do it alone, she did this with me. You people did it with me. But I know every word in this book. I got to tell y'all, you know, because I am a big book person. I've read this book more than you can ever imagine. But I will tell you that one of the best lines in this book, that would be all well and good, but if you fail to enlarge upon your spiritual life, all of it would mean nothing. And if I didn't apply all these principles into my life, all would be nothing. If I didn't go about and start changing, all would be nothing. But when I first got sober, I was a big crybaby. I cried for years because you had family. Your family loved you. I'm telling you, you're very fortunate to have your family. My family wasn't there for me, and it killed me. They told me that I had to call my family, you know, to get them involved. As soon as they heard my name, they just hung up. Just broke my heart. And so for a couple of years, I cried. And my sponsor, who really believed in these things called the steps, when I was 3 months sober, I was already on my fourth and fifth step. And I will tell you that from a person who didn't understand the word powerless at all, I didn't even know what it meant because, see, I was very powerful. But I was powerless. And I learned that I was powerless over alcohol two different ways. The first way, I was powerless over it physically. And you can understand this. Once I put this in my body, all bets are off. You know, I don't care how many times I said to myself that I'm just going to take that one drink. Once it entered me, I was physically incapable of not having more. I can tell you, I don't know where I was going to end up, who I was going to end up, where I was going to end up. And then I was powerless over it mentally, being bone dry, not having a drink in you. How come I pick up, again, knowing all the trouble it causes me? How come I do that? Because I am powerless over it. I have this obsession that I think that I'm capable of going out and having that one drink. Because, see, I was delusional. I believed my own lie. And so my sponsor and I got down when we got to the fourth step, and I will tell you that it was really, I didn't have trouble doing it. The fear I had is I wanted to do it right. And then all it says is just to do it thorough and honestly. It doesn't say anything about perfection. And so I ended up doing this four-step, but I saw the truth about Sammy. And that was a pretty hard thing for me to swallow. I swallowed some big chunks about Sammy. And but what it, I will tell you, it's probably the step that set me free. I mean, I have that freedom of bondage of self from that, because that's where everything, and y'all know from 3 to 9, everything just takes off. And so when I got to, 6, and it's a very powerful step, you know, because I really did want to change, and I found out that I couldn't do it, that I had to be entirely ready to let this power, because I'm powerless, and if I'm powerless, I better find a power that's going to take care of me, that power was going to help me change. And so, because I already had the willingness. But when it came to the ninth step, the first thing that my sponsor told me to do is I had to start writing my mom. And guys, I didn't want to do it because I don't like doing anything that's too hard. You know, I don't like anything that I feel like I'm going to get rejected. And so that's what I did. I started writing my mom. And after 2 years, my mom wrote me back and told me it was time for us to meet. And so I met my mom, you know, and I had to meet on her terms where she wanted to meet. But I met my mom, and I will tell y'all that this is truly a family disease. If you don't think that we affect other people, we do. You know, it's like throwing that stone on that water, and the ripples just take off. And so what happened is I started developing this relationship, but it wasn't easy at first. You know, I was the type of person, because I wasn't kind, I wasn't considerate. Every time my mom opened her mouth, I just seemed to jump right in it. I was so defensive. I don't know where that came from, but I was just so defensive with my mom. So over the years, I got that relationship with her. After 2 years of paying people back, I had to pay that guy who I stole from. I was sending him money orders because I was a code 6 at banks. They wouldn't give me a checking account. I don't know why. They thought forgery wasn't a good thing or something. So I started writing sending out money orders to all these people because my sponsor was real big on amends, and especially financial amends. And if y'all don't know this by now, but they're probably the easiest ones to make. I don't like to let go of my money, but she goes, it's not your money. And so I started paying this guy back. And after 2 years, he called me back and he said, would you work for me again? And so I became the dishwasher at that restaurant. And 11 years later, I own that restaurant. Huh. Come full circle. And I have to tell you, my husband and I own that restaurant. I'm not an ambitious person. I wasn't doing the steps. I wasn't paying back because I thought of the future. I wasn't paying back because I knew that that would happen or there was something. I was doing that because it was the next right thing to do, even when I didn't think it was. Every time I take that one stitch, and one of my favorite speakers, Don M., he talks about a tapestry, and all that tapestry is God's work, and that's the results, but I just need to take that stitch. And that's what I was doing. I was taking the stitch and leaving the result up to God. Now, I still had some expectations, because when I wrote to my sisters and brothers, you know, to make amends, I really did expect, you know, I was going to be that prodigal daughter, you know, that the red carpet was going to be laid out and all that would be fine. But it didn't happen. And it killed me, you know. But I had that relationship going with my mom. After 11 years, my oldest brother calls me and he said, Sammy, it's about time we meet. And I said, okay. Where does that come from? If he would have called me earlier, I would have gone, where were you? I hate you. You know, you should have been there when I needed you. But what came out of my mouth was okay. Because he always thought it was in their court. And if you're young in sobriety and you think everything is everybody else's court, it's all up to them. See, it was in God's time. God had to heal my heart. Because my heart was full of hate. My heart was full of resentment. My heart was full of fear. And see, all of a sudden, where did that go? How does that happen? So I met with my brother, and I say the word met because, you know, when you're in fear, it's really hard to get to know somebody. It's hard to know people when you're in fear. It's hard to know yourself because you're not yourself. The big book says God either is or he isn't. What is your choice to be? So fear is a choice. I didn't want to live in fear anymore. You know, I came in and I had this much fear going on. I was fearful of everything. And over time, because of the principles that we practice, that we put in action, starts getting less and less. And the fear is right here and the courage is this much. It just takes place. God does abhors, you know, space. Something is always going to take its place. And so for me, doing the nine step. I had some pretty tough nine steps to do. This is the type of person I was. When I was working at the Village Cafe, I fired someone for stealing when I stole it myself. I mean, that's not good. That's not good. That's not an easy an amends to make. And it turned out to be that guy was a big-time lawyer in Richmond. Of all things, he had to be, you know. But when I went to him, and I went to him with my head up, because my sponsor told me to keep my head up. And I went to him, and I made those amends. And do you know that guy forgave me? He forgave me. How does that happen? How are there people like that? I know today. I do know today. But, you know, and it's years later, he came into our restaurant almost every morning. You know, and it was like nothing had ever happened. It was water over the dam. And it was like we were friends. God is good. God has been good to me. When I was, it was in 1996, I had met a guy in the program, and I will tell you, he liked me more than I liked him. And we started talking, started becoming friends, and I will tell you, I was not good at this. I was in hate with a lot of men, so I... Remember, he asked me out, and my words were over my dead body. That was very nice, wasn't I? But what happened is I started hanging out with this guy, and we became friends. And I don't know how that ever happened in my life, because I never had really a good relationship with anybody that I can ever remember. And my husband and I, we got married, and we had an AA wedding. You know, the big book says, great events will come to pass. And that's a great event for me. Because, see, I never could see myself with anybody. I could never see myself, you know, being able to be selfless. You know, to put someone ahead of myself. Ooh, that just wasn't even a thought of mine before. So we got married. And during that time, my husband has gotten sick. And I got to tell you about Alcoholics Anonymous as a fellowship. People came together for me and for him. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see where people come and just help you out. I mean, who would have thought? But I love Alcoholics Anonymous so much. When I got to the 12th step, my spirit had become awakened. You know, I woke up. And it's because of those 12 steps. Even when I was the laziest thing and I didn't want to do anything like that, my feet became the most spiritual part of my body. I said, I'm not going to go to that meeting. I'm not going to go to that meeting. I'm not going to go to the meeting. And my feet are doing the thing. So, you know, my head didn't have to be there because my body was doing the work for me. When I got to that step, you know, and I started sponsoring people, I will tell you I'm a real big fan of sponsorship. Sponsorship is, you know, helping others is just the name of the game for me. I've been sponsoring people since I was 1 year sober. And I sponsor a lot of women, and it's not because I'm so great, it's because I'm available. I heard a speaker say, and I just mentioned it today too, someone asked him, how many people do you sponsor? And his reply was, oh, around half of them. Isn't that the truth? But I will tell you something about sponsorship. The girls that I sponsor, and even the other women, have held me together. In my lowest of times, they have held me together. Because, you know, just getting sober, things aren't going to be wonderful all the time. You're going to go through a lot of hard times and a lot of great times. But if it wasn't for the people, for me, that sponsorship family, I tell you, I don't know where I would be. You know, I've had that spiritual awakening, and I'm passing that on. I will tell you that God, and my relationship with God, because that's really what got me here. When I said what seemed at first a flimsy read, everything seemed like a flimsy read to me at the beginning. You know, picking up the phone, making phone calls. I've been going to prison for 22 years. You know, making coffee. What do you do at your home group? You know, are you active in your home group? You know, I'm still setting up my home group. I'll never be too old to be making coffee and setting up my home group. You know, and it's because of all those things that I do, you know, that are going to keep me sober. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober, and I appreciate y'all being here. Thank you. Wow.